This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Picture this. You're one of 1 million sitting in a queue waiting to snap up a ticket to your favourite artist. Maybe you don't have to imagine too hard because this was you a few days, weeks ago. You're trying to get these tickets that everyone's trying to get. And just when you're hoping you might get through, bam, they're all gone. You missed out. And you're thinking about all those other people ahead of you who were lucky, who did get the tickets, and kind of upset. But you think, oh, well, good on them. Maybe you don't think that. Was it luck, though, that got those people the tickets? And how many of those ahead of you in the queue were actually human beings? And how many were bots? We're going to take you in this podcast through the orchestrated online scheme people are using to buy up and scalp tickets at huge markups. There is nothing new here. People have always been trying to profit off very sought-after items, tickets. What is interesting, though, is how they're using the technology, how it all works, whether this is illegal. You might not know much about it. We're going to break it all down. Also coming up, the student supermarket that's offering free groceries to struggling students. Could this be rolled out in other places? First, though.
Hack.
Bots are notorious for one thing, and that's going big or going home.
On Triple J.
Did you get Fred Again tickets? If you did, well done. Definitely the most sought-after live performance tickets in Australia right now. Surprise shows popping up. Melbourne, the GC, Sydney. Maybe you're ready to go now. Or you're getting ready. Or desperately trying to get your hands on some last-minute tickets so you don't miss out. If you weren't successful, you'll know how disappointing it is waiting in that queue with hundreds of thousands of others only to be told they're all gone. But it's all good because there's a heap of people selling them on Marketplace or Gumtree for hundreds of dollars. The thing is, the people selling these tickets aren't necessarily getting rid of them because they can't go to the shows anymore. Hack's been looking into a really sophisticated scheme of ticket scalping that's using bots to buy up as many tickets as possible before you can. It may not surprise you, but you may not know how this works. And Fred Again fans are just the latest targets. Ellie Grounds has been looking into it.
If you're one of the thousands of people who missed out on Fred Again tickets when they went on sale a couple weeks ago, then the last few days of Fred videos everywhere on social media has probably been pretty tough for you. Fred landed in Australia and, as he often does, announced a bunch of surprise shows. Ticketek says more than 1 million people queued for the more than 100,000 tickets to his 7 arena shows in Melbourne, Sydney and on the Gold Coast. But it seems not all of those fans were real people. They were bots.
At its simplest, bot being robot is literally just a piece of computer code that's designed to perform an action over and over again, way faster than any person possibly could.
Sam Crowther is the CEO of Casada, a cybersecurity company which helps its clients defend against bots.
It's very easy for a bot to, say, have 10 million copies of itself all lined up. And so they're playing the numbers game. Right? They're just, you know, assuming that, hey, if we can outnumber people 10 to 1, we're going to secure 10x more tickets than any one individual could.
Hack has seen a private online community with at least 500 members discussing the use of bots to snap up Fred Again tickets en masse to then on-sell them to the general public at a huge markup. Posts on the forum include stuff like which shows to target based on individual state laws, which ones are likely to be more in demand, and recommendations for how much they should charge for tickets.
In regards of retail potential, my key event to target would be the Gold Coast. The reason for this is it's a Saturday, close to Brisbane to get a major crowd. Gold Coast don't really get much love, looking like the only Queensland show.
Recommended ticket resell. General admission, recommended retail price $179.90. Resell $250+. More likely $300 to $350, but depends on panic sellers.
The big business of botting has a few layers. First, a bot developer will build the bot tool using code. Then someone will use that bot to get on a ticketing website and get their hands on as many tickets as possible. I've seen screenshots of people in these forums posting their multiple purchase confirmation emails from Ticketek. One person had 17 emails. So times that by 4 tickets per transaction, and that's 68 tickets in their hands. They then sell those tickets at a slight markup to an intermediary reseller, who then sells it to someone like you or me for an even bigger markup. Sam and his team have analysed the posts on just one of these online forums. There are multiple doing the same thing. An estimate roughly 20% of the tickets bought to Fred's 7 arena shows are being funneled through that forum and were most likely bought by bots.
From what we can see so far, and again, these tickets sometimes take time to hit these secondary markets, we see about 17 or 18,000 of them up for sale in this method.
Sam reckons some people doing this would probably make between 10 and 15 grand.
Literally the reason bots are used is you can scale up these sorts of operations and you can make them very, very lucrative.
Ticketek told Hack it was able to stop 1 million bots from accessing Fred tickets. Okay, so is this kind of thing legal? Well, anyone who uses Ticketek's website agrees not to use a robot for any unauthorised purposes. So technically any ticket bought using a bot breaches those contract terms and could be cancelled. But whether it's an actual offence depends on where you live.
Some states and territories don't have ticket scalping laws and don't have bot laws.
Law professor Jeannie Patterson from the University of Melbourne wants uniform legislation on this stuff because right now it changes from state to state. New South Wales does have anti-bot and anti-scalping laws. Victoria and Queensland don't have anti-bot laws. They do have anti-scalping laws, which say you can't resell a ticket for more than 110% of the original price. But they would have only applied if Fred shows there were deemed a major event or at a major venue. And they weren't. Jeannie says the current laws don't really stop botters from operating.
If we have laws that focus on scalping rather than the bot attack, so to speak, it's the middle person or the innocent purchaser that suffers.
She says it's hard for lawmakers to keep up.
That's why the law generally goes for the gatekeeper. They go for the person who's reselling the tickets, they go for Ticketek, they go for the digital platforms, because the person running the technology is moving so fast, the lawmakers can't catch them.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that story. A lot of messages coming through. Someone says we bought tickets on resale for Fred again that were definitely bought using a bot system. Another person says even if it is illegal, I don't see the law being effective against interstate and international scalpers. As you heard, Ticketek did provide us with a statement for this story, but they came back to us this afternoon with another statement telling Hack estimates that up to 30% of tickets were bought by bots are unsubstantiated and refuted by Ticketek. They say their data shows bots were a small fraction of total traffic and the scenario of bots purchasing the tickets as reported was not possible. They also say they identified more than 50 million requests from 188,000 bots and were able to mitigate those malicious attempts. They say those are the most up-to-date figures and also that they leverage the best security to prevent bot activities. So a lot that Ticketek's saying there. Also, I should say that we reached out to Fred again for comment too. Let's dive into this a bit more now with someone who is across how all of this works. Shannon Connie is a computer security expert and lecturer at the Uni of Melbourne and is with us now. Hey, Shannon, thanks for coming on Hack.
Hey, good to speak.
With all the bots and the technology being used out there, everything we're hearing, is it just going to keep getting harder and harder to get your hands on tickets in Australia?
So in terms of catching the people running these giant botnets, it's really, really tricky because they're globally dispersed and also have the ability to update their technology really quickly. So what that means for the average punter is that over time, it's quite possible that the problem gets worse and not better. The defenders have a much harder time than the attackers, in this case, the bot masters.
So do we know how widespread it is here?
Figures in the public are actually pretty hard to come by, and it's unlikely that even the companies selling the tickets themselves really know the actual figures. They can make guesses based on the patterns that bots normally follow and how many requests they block. But as to how many of the tickets ultimately got sold to bots, no one really knows.
All right. Do we know how much people are making through it? Because it has to be really lucrative, obviously, for people to invest so much time in doing this. Is there any idea?
on a single ticket, you could make as much as 3 to 4 times the face value of the ticket on that one transaction. Wow. And of course, the botters are going to be trying to get anywhere from the tens to the hundreds to the thousands of tickets. So you multiply that up and you can get to the hundreds of thousands of profit without too much difficulty.
As we just heard in Ellie's story, the laws are different across the country. In the US as well, like around the world, they've tried to crack down on bots. They had this thing called the Bots Act. Did it work? Like, what was that, and was it successful in cracking down on this kind of activity?
So the Bots Act was passed in 2016, and in the entire, like, we're getting close to the 10-year mark. In that period, only one instance of the law actually being pursued happened, and that was in 2021 with a $3.7 million judgment. So in a 10-year-ish period, to only have one instance of the law actually being pursued, I think that's an indicator that the Bots Act hasn't been very successful.
Right. Okay. That's so interesting. I mean, what is the answer, I guess? And I know that's a hard question. People are probably trying to think of what to do. Like, there are all these state laws. Is it something at a federal level that politicians should be looking at? What do you reckon?
So firstly, making sure that we have some consistency is helpful in ensuring that botmasters can't just escape by running their schemes in a different state. But as to what legislation would actually be effective, something that's helped the ordinary punter the most is just restricting the sale price of the ticket. So limiting it to 10% over face value for major events has been helpful. But again, you get things slipping through when something hasn't been declared a major event, or there hasn't been time to actually declare something a major event, like in the case of Fred again, where the concert's only announced like a week or two before, and so there isn't even enough time to make that declaration.
And I mean, we're talking about tickets at the moment, but can you just spell out just how widespread, these bots are used for purchasing, buying up other stuff to sell on to people around the world?
So bots can get used for anything where there's a limited supply and it's kind of first come, first serve. So another example would be shoes that go on a limited release or other fashion items. And in one example from my misspent youth, I even used it to a bot that I'd written to get a place for my P plate test as fast as I could.
Oh, admission.
That was only once, but it happened.
And so did you get Fred again tickets, Sean?
I did not get Fred again tickets, but I did get Taylor Swift tickets. However, I was not using a bot for that, thankfully. I've learned my lesson since the P plates.
Okay, you're a professional now. Well, hey, we appreciate you breaking all that down for us. Sean and Connie from the Uni of Melbourne, thank you very much for coming on Hack.
Thanks very much. Good to speak.
And we got a lot of messages coming through. Someone says, I miss the day when they would allocate some tickets to a physical box office queue. At this rate, I don't mind queuing. Someone else on Hack's Instagram says, why is Australia so behind in cybersecurity? These bot issues are controlled so much better in the US and the UK. Another person, I know people who bought tickets to his Opera House show for $750. Someone else, so unfair, these bots are going to always win unless it's prohibited to resell for more than the ticket value. And then another person says, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Hack.
This photograph was released to maybe calm the public, but actually it's raised more questions.
On Triple J.
This saga over Kate Middleton disappearing, reappearing is dragging, right? But it also keeps getting stranger every day. Strange enough for a lot of you to be obsessed, even if you don't usually care about royal news. You don't want to keep up to date with it, but you do want to be up to date with this story. There are heaps of conspiracy theories about the Princess of Wales online. She basically hasn't been seen in public for months. A family photo released a few days ago was meant to kind of end all of the rumours and clear things up, put people's minds at ease, but it's actually made things a lot worse. Arianna Lucente explains.
What in the botch Photoshop is this?
Either we're all collectively losing it or we have the right to be concerned.
But if the palace really wanted the rumours to stop, this has got to be the worst way to do it.
Where is Kate Middleton? The saga surrounding the Princess of Wales' disappearance from the public eye has taken a very strange turn, and it comes in the form of a seemingly innocent family photo released on Mother's Day in the UK.
The Princess of Wales was pictured alongside her three children in a photo that was taken by Prince William last week.
But pretty soon after the image came out, multiple photo agencies like Associated Press and Reuters issued a kill notice for it, saying the image was manipulated.
Look at Princess Charlotte's sleeve. You can see there's a bit missing. Look at the Princess of Wales's jacket zip.
It doesn't line up. And then there's this hand. It's a bit blurry.
Kate Middleton released an apology online saying, "Like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused. But while it's been admitted that some kind of photo manipulation has taken place, Kensington Palace say they're not going to release the original unedited pic. And the internet is going wild.
The fingers are giving AI generated.
I really believe that this photo was taken back in November of 2023. And if you know anything about Kate Middleton, you know that people obsessively track her fashion. The same exact shoes and the same exact kind of looking pants.
So this girl on Twitter shows the Vogue cover and then overlays it with this picture, and I'll show you guys, it is crazy. This girl on Twitter cracked the case.
Now, to be clear, these are all just theories, and there's debate about why the palace might be throwing Kate under the bus by not releasing the original image. But it's all feeding into the conspiracies online about what's going on with her. A bit of background, Kate was hospitalized in January for a planned abdominal procedure. She hasn't been seen in public since Christmas, except for a paparazzi pic published on TMZ earlier this month of her and her mum in a car near Windsor Castle, although some people online still don't believe it's her. And after the Mother's Day pic came out, photographers have captured images of William and Kate leaving Windsor, again in a car, but her face is turned away from the camera.
You know, it started as like a bit of a conspiracy, but now it's turning into a full-fledged modern-day mystery.
Is something seriously wrong with Kate's health? Have her and William broken up? Is she recovering from plastic surgery? Or is it just a bad haircut? Whether you care about the rumours or not, the public's reaction could indicate potential instability of the monarchy, at least perceptions of it.
Kate has been, since they started dating in university, kind of the good royal, right? She's been the one who turned up on the steps of the hospital after the birth of all three children. She's always played the role, right? She's been this sort of icon of motherhood. There's this kind of pouring in of conspiracy theories, and I think it comes from that place of this expectation, this assumption that she will turn up and she will be the good royal, and she's just gone.
And an increasing distrust of the royal family when it comes to transparency.
This picture, which was designed to be this kind of beacon of reassurance in this mad world of online conspiracy, only served to fuel that debate and raise more questions than it answered, in fact, because people were then saying, well, is she really there at all? This element of telling the truth and relating in a kind of sensible and simple way with the public that they're supposed to serve, that had all been kind of shot through in a very clumsy attempt at reassurance.
Hack on Triple J.
Arianna Lecente with that update, or the latest on a story that really has been captivating a lot of people around the world. Updates every morning. Someone says they should have hired me to do the Photoshop instead. Reese says Kate's been replaced by a bot, perhaps. It's Reese's opinion. And heaps of you also getting in touch with the wild conspiracy theories that you've heard. Look, definitely there's going to be more coverage of that, I think, but it's time to move on.
Hack.
Every student's affected, even if they live at home, in one way or another.
On Triple J.
Student poverty is hitting so many of your heart. You tell us that all of the time, not being able to afford food, the basics of living every day. A lot of you telling us you're struggling to stay healthy by eating as well, because you're eating whatever you can afford and not necessarily what is good for you. Shopping is a nightmare. Imagine though, you turn up to the supermarket, you go to do your weekly shop, get everything that you need, and then when you get to the checkout, you're just waved through. All that food was for free. You don't have to pay for anything. Is this a dream? Not for some Victorian students. A free student supermarket has been set up. So how exactly is it going to work? And could it work in more places across the country? Ballarat reporter Lexi Junawick explains.
When you're at the shops getting your groceries and you feel that stress creeping in at what the final total is going to be, have you ever thought, could the world be doing food differently?
There is a significant issue around the systemic way our economy is set up, and it's failing people.
And if hearing all this noise instinctively fills you with a bit of dread, maybe you'd agree with this sentiment.
You look at food inflation, it's running higher than base inflation. I think we're seeing more and more people struggling to make ends meet.
Dave McNamara is the chief executive of Food Bank, which is a hunger relief charity that connects other charities with surplus food and groceries to help people in need. Just last year, they opened a new food bank hub in Ballarat, and soon they're going to try something new.
And that'll allow those students going through higher education at the moment that are having trouble putting food on their own tables to be able to self-choose the food that they're familiar with and they know how to cook.
They're running a pilot with Federation University where certain students can shop for food at the new food bank hub for free. It's for students experiencing food insecurity, kind of like a referral supermarket.
Too many kids are dropping out of higher ed with a hex debt and then trying to get work with a debt existing. So we're making sure that they have the food that they need to make sure that they can stay and engage in their educational journey.
And students are stoked. Here's Thomas Birmingham Glover. He works with the Student Senate, which represents students at Federation Uni.
It's very welcome news. I know that a lot of students, particularly last year, have been raising a lot of concern around how they're going to continue to study with the cost of living crisis.
The trial will start during O Week, which for Fed Uni is next week. I asked Samantha Bartlett from the uni about how all this will work.
I think we need to come with the position if they've put their hand up and come in to a food pantry on site at our university, I think we can rest assured that they wouldn't be doing that unless they felt it was necessary. So we don't get them to jump through hoops.
Samantha says the uni hopes the program will help students from disadvantaged backgrounds.
25% of our students are from what is regarded as low SES backgrounds. 48% of our students are regional and remote.
Foodbank says they'll suss out how the pilot goes over a six-month trial, but funding is a bit of a barrier right now, with both the state and federal governments yet to commit any funding to the project's expansion.
Ballarat's a population of around 130,000 people now, and I think the last data we looked at, the food insecurity rate is running at around 10 to 12%. You know, that's around 15,000 people. So if you imagine 15,000 people trying to come to the food centre, well, that's not a viable, it's just not a big enough centre.
Outside of this uni pilot, Foodbank usually stocks other charities with food to help their clients. One of those is Uniting. That's where Warwick Davison is from, and he says demand is increasing, not just in Ballarat, but across regional Victoria.
We're turning away 25 people a day that are requesting support down through Wyndham that we just can't get to because we don't have the resources to be able to support them.
At Federation Uni, there's a lot of hope that this free supermarket trial will do so much more than stock empty pantries.
Good nutrition is vital for well-being, mental health and academic success. Students just coming to university, it's not just about passing the subjects. They are a whole person, and as a university, we need to take responsibility for them as a whole person.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Lexi Junawick with that story. I'm wondering what you think about it. Free supermarkets for people who need them. It's not just this idea. Like, people have done it across the country. Someone says the University of Newcastle has a really similar system with food. If you think this should be rolled out more, message in 0439757555. Maybe you've had an experience with this kind of food situation, grocery situation. The project is happening in another part of the country as well, a similar project anyway, to help people with rising costs. And I'm going to chat with someone now who set up a not-for-profit supermarket in the Pilbara in WA. And basically what it does is it gives free food to struggling First Nations members of the community while also providing employment. It's a regular supermarket for those who can afford to buy there. It kind of does everything. So let's find out how. Sean Paul Stevens is the CEO of the Nalama Yinjabandi Foundation. He's going to tell us about it. G'day, Sean Paul. Thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Can you explain how your not-for-profit supermarket works in your Pilbara community?
The really interesting thing about our social supermarket is it's 100% owned by the local traditional owner community of Irumugadu. We do food rescue from local towns like Karratha and Wickham. from the major supermarkets, and we bring that food into our small not-for-profit supermarket. So elders, young families can come in and access food for free, and we also sell goods off the shelf at a reduced price for local people.
How long has the supermarket been operating like this?
We've been operating under this model for about 3 years. One of the really beautiful things is it's based on a cultural principle called Ninyat, which is a word in Nyalam and Indjibani, which means I look after you, you look after me. We look after country, country looks after us. I look after Nana, Nana looks after me, so on and so forth. And so the principle around this is we don't own this. The food is there for all of community. And that's how cultural practice was pre-European arrival. If someone got a kangaroo, then cuts of the kangaroo went all across the community. So this is really just a modern way of that working.
Can I just ask how sustainable it is? Because it's obviously been going for a few years, so the system appears to be working, but do you have times where there's not very much food donated, that there's limited supplies available for people, or is it a constant supply of essential staple items for people to access?
It's a huge challenge. In regional and remote areas, the issue is supply and logistics, and that's what creates significant food insecurity and cost of living pressures in those areas. So we're at the mercy of that as well. The model is built so that we can actually get what the supermarkets have in surplus in towns that are not too far away, but we are at the mercy of what is available from them and also what we can purchase in. So you raise a good point. How sustainable is a model like that? The model is social enterprise, so anyone can come in and shop, not just for the local Aboriginal community. And if people come in and spend money in there, we use whatever profit is generated to purchase in more food and hire local people. So all of the floor staff are local Aboriginal people, you know, traditional owners who own the store. So it's that really interesting merging of cultural practice and a co-op model.
So is it only the First Nations locals who are able to access the food for free, or is that how that works, or anyone who is struggling can access the food?
As a traditional owner organisation, our primary driver is to support the First Nations community. But again, one of the really beautiful cultural principles for the Nyalam Indjibani Foundation is the elders don't turn away anyone who need support. And we found that there's an increasing number of people, non-Indigenous community members who live in the Northwest who are suffering food insecurity, who come to us as well. And we never turn anyone away. Our primary driver is to make sure we have a more livable and prosperous community. Roben as a community suffers significant social and economic disadvantage. It is almost entirely Indigenous community, but it is surrounded by some of the most prosperous economic output in Australia. So the Pilbara region has $100 billion a year of economic output, but there's small communities like Roben that suffer extreme social and economic disadvantage. The majority of people that suffer that disadvantage are the traditional owner community, but there are other people as well, and we absolutely support them as much as we can.
Sean Paul, have you noticed in the 3 years that it's been operating the kind of impact it's had on the community, whether, you know, outcomes have changed for people, whether you've noticed people talk about the good that it's doing?
It's really interesting. I'll give you a couple of really interesting examples of what it did, and we didn't know it was going to do this. So yes, it helped address food security. More young people, more elders have food at home and then can use their money to spend on the vital things that they need. But it did something else. It started enabling cultural practice. So ceremony is still very strong in this part of Australia. Young men are initiated every year. And part of the initiation and cultural practice is families give food away. And the store has actually enabled people from other communities to continue to participate in those really ancient ceremonial practices. So not only does it help with food security and cost of living, it actually enhances cultural practice, which is something we didn't know. When the elders designed it, they knew that it would help kids getting food at school and elders getting food at home, but we've had these really other interesting benefits to the community.
Sean Paul Stevens from the Nyalam Indjibani Foundation, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
And some messages coming through. Sam from Meanjin, Brisbane says, when I was at uni, I had to dumpster dive a few times. A food bank is an amazing idea, especially if they're taking the stuff that supermarkets are binning, as there was always a depressing amount of perfectly good food thrown away. And Tiger from Port Macquarie says, I recently became suddenly homeless when a pipe burst in my rental unit. I've been accessing a lot of food and emergency relief programs. Also getting a lot of messages from the Fred Again story, ticket scalping. Chris from Melbourne says the only way to stop the bots is in-person ticket sales. In the world of bot and AI tools, the real world is the only defence. And Corin in Melbourne says, I met Fred last year at a bar randomly and got personally invited to his sideshow in Melbourne last year. It was so good. Saw him in Melbourne again recently. It was next level shit. And I mean, that's the experience everyone wants, Corin. And so many people this week and, you know, over the next little while looking forward to amazing times at Fred Again shows. That is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time. See ya. Hack.